Justice. This is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 15th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Chris Gao, Sam Bowman, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Reed Johnson. Their producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Eric Tegetoff, Suzanne Potter, Nadia Romlagan, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you're not a member and would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, and we're going to be talking about two of his new articles in this week's paper concerning Portland's so-called daytime camping ban, the court case against it, and the city's plans for alternative shelter sites. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. So your first piece is called Circuit Court Judge Halts Enforcement of Portland Sleeping Ordinance. And this comes as a result of a lawsuit from the Oregon Law Center. What can you tell me about the ordinance and the lawsuit against it?
This is the lawsuit that technically went into effect in July after Portland City Council voted in June. And it is an updated ordinance, amended ordinance that effectively kind of criminalizes homelessness during the hours of 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., among other things. And so this was to go into effect. The mayor announced a couple weeks ago that they were going to start enforcing this ban on November 13th, which is Monday. And this judge decided that to issue a temporary injunction.
What is the claims that this lawsuit makes about why this ordinance shouldn't be enforced?
Yeah, this is, the city says that this aligns with, they were forced to amend their ordinance so that it would align with an Oregon law that was passed actually in 2021. So they've had 2 years to come up with this. That law says that all time, place, and manner ordinances within any city in Oregon needs to be objectively reasonable with regard to people experiencing homelessness. So the city says that they're trying to align their code so that it is in line with state law, but the Oregon Law Center argues that this is violates the Oregon Constitution, and it is also objectively unreasonable for a myriad reasons. Homeless people are not allowed to have fires so that they can't cook food. There's like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. people are supposed to be taking any stuff that they have with them, pack up a tent, carry it. That creates all kinds of issues for people with disabilities, among other things. So that's kind of the central point of the Oregon Law Center lawsuit. And it's a civil case. They're representing 5 people within that class and all other Portlanders who are similarly affected by the ordinance.
Well, like you mentioned, the standard is that these laws have to be, quote unquote, objectively reasonable. And one of the Oregon Law Center's arguments is that what is reasonable to housed Portlanders isn't the same as what is objectively reasonable to people experiencing homelessness. What is the significance of that difference?
Yeah, that's actually a little bit of the text of the law with regard to people experiencing homelessness, saying that It needs, this is a really important point. Ed Johnson is the lead attorney on this case, and he argued in court that, you know, anyone in that court might have an idea of what is reasonable when they're sitting at a computer in the comfort of their own home or out during the day, but have a home to go to at night. But their class, this class of homeless court lenders who are suing the city, have submitted a lot of testimonies saying why this is all objectively unreasonable for them to be able to actually abide by this law. No one can really figure out how they are supposed to abide by that law. The city, on the other hand, Ed Johnson argued, didn't present, despite, you know, all of the opportunities to do so, didn't submit any testimony from anyone actually experiencing homelessness who said that this law was objectively reasonable.
So Judge Rima Gondor granted a temporary injunction to stop the enforcement from starting on Monday, November 13th. What does that mean for the city and for the case?
Yeah, so while the court case is ongoing, the city is not going to be allowed to enforce those aspects of that ordinance, the newer aspects of the ordinance that they're being sued over. It is really important to note that the city can still sweep people. There's still a process. There's a 72-hour notice that people are given, and there are still certain, you know, sort of sit lie, time, place, and manner restrictions. It's just not those the criminal aspects of that. So they can't. This was to add up to $100 fines, up to 30 days in jail, and they're just these sort of criminal penalties that won't be able to be enforced. So you might still see people being swept, and people may still be swept, but the criminal aspect is taken out while the case is still ongoing.
And how high of a bar is it for a case like this to clear in order to get a temporary injunction? Obviously, it's important at this stage because their claim is that it would create irreparable harm.
Yeah, they went in already trying to get a temporary restraining order, the Oregon Law Center, earlier in this case. That was just a month and a half ago, I think, and that was not granted, the restraining order. Part of the reason that the restraining order request was denied was that the judge found that couldn't find how it was actually harming people in the moment. So that whole metric changed as soon as the city said it was going to begin enforcing it. Temporary injunction is a really high bar in that the plaintiff needs, which is the Oregon Law Center in this case, needs to show the judge that they actually have a high likelihood of winning this in the long run. So this is to kick things back to the status quo, which is not enforcement, essentially on the basis that ultimately this case is likely to prevail. The plaintiffs are likely to prevail, and the so-called daytime camping ban will not be allowed.
Have you seen any estimates about how long the case will be in court for?
I haven't seen any estimates. I did see that the city has already submitted trying to get additional reasoning from the plaintiffs and from the judge actually on why she actually issued this temporary injunction. So I expect they'll be kind of battling back and forth for a while, but no real estimate.
Well, part of the city's argument is that the structure of this ordinance would allow them to refer people to temporary alternative shelter sites or a TAS site. And that ties into your other article in the paper this week. It's called "The City Has a Lot of Work to Do Before Its Next TAS Site Is Ready for People. DEQ is waiting on a risk assessment from the city to inform cleanup plans for the contaminated site." To start, what is this TAS site and what does the city envision it becoming?
Yeah, so the city has a vision of, you know, these temporary alternative shelter sites that are, you know, dispersed around. They've actually improved quite a bit from their initial proposal, which was just sort of tents with 3,000 people on them. This temporary alternative shelter site was announced at the end of October, and it's going in North Portland off Portland Road. We did a little bit of digging into that right away. My editor, Kay Rambo, sent me this report from DEQ showing that the site there is contaminated. It has been contaminated for a long time. And, you know, with things like PCE, TCE, known carcinogens. So there's a lot of cleanup that the city needs to undergo before that would be actually ready for people to move in.
How many people does it envision staying there?
This one's a little bit different from the prior site, which is right off of Powell, in that this one has space for RVs and also has some pods, a little bit of space for tents. And Mayor Wheeler's office in a press release said that they expect to be able to hold 200 people.
What's this land been used for previously, and what's the state of it now?
Yeah, this site was purchased in 2001 by the Bureau of Environmental Services. And prior to that, it had this long history of industrial activities. So since at least the 1940s, according to the DEQ report, the site was a shingle mill, boat manufacturer and repair facility. They've stored various materials over the years, and, you know, tank truck washing facilities. So there's a lot of industrial kind of stuff out there on the site.
So like you mentioned, there's chemicals in the soil and groundwater, tetrachloroethylene and trichloroethylene. How serious are they?
Depending on the exposure to them and for how long, these can, you know, be pretty terrible. They're known carcinogens and you know, have some kind of neurological effects for people over a long period of time. Again, this kind of depends on, you know, just kind of being there for a second. I think a lot of people will think of hazmat suits and stuff like that. This isn't exactly like that, but over, you know, some extended periods of time, this could have an issue, you know, a lot of health issues for people. But that's what DEQ and hopefully Bureau of Environmental Services are looking to address.
What kind of abatements might the city be able to do to address these chemicals?
It really all hinges on this. I kept looking for a really straight answer, but it does apparently really hinge on how long people are going to be at that site and what the use, you know, what the use is for. So they can do things like, you know, pave over the top of it, you know, which maybe keeps some of those contaminants under the soil. They have, you know, other remediation processes for ensuring that that doesn't get into the Columbia Slough, which is right nearby, or whatever. But yeah, it depends a lot. If somebody's going to be there for 30 years, that would be a certain kind of risk. But if they're going to be there for 6 months, that would be a whole other thing. Being in direct contact with the soil seems to be the main concern. And the city and DEQ do appear to be interested in going through that whole process to remediate the area.
Well, it's not the first time that improving a place like this has happened. It's called a brownfield, right? Can you tell me about some other places in Portland that used to have kind of a similar legacy?
Right. Yeah, brownfields are pretty common. That's kind of an EPA term. And yeah, I mean, the Pearl District was a brownfield at one point. Most of NATO Parkway was a brownfield at some point. And they're just kind of all around. It's not totally uncommon. We have been doing, you know, living in an industrialized world for a long time, and so these sites exist. Remediation is important, obviously, for people, but also for the environment.
So where is the process at now in terms of taking the site from what it is now and getting it to be a task site?
DEQ is, I was sort of surprised how quickly I got people from DEQ on the phone. And so they do seem pretty interested in what happens at the site. The process really depends on the Bureau of Environmental Services doing that risk assessment, telling DEQ what they plan to do, and then sending those results in so that DEQ can help come up with the cleanup. The city is really trying to push this quite a bit more quickly than a process like this might normally take. It seems like there were kind of no plans for that site for a long time. The city kind of more in like the city hall kind of political kind of realm decided, hey, we should put this over here, and then now the bureaus are all kind of working it out to try to push it through really quick.
Which department is ultimately going to be doing the cleanup?
So DEQ will ultimately create that whole plan for the cleanup, and I believe the Bureau of Environmental Services will do that cleanup. They will be working together to get from, there's a whole process, I think it's 8 different phases that they need to go through, and they kind of kick things back and forth as to whose responsibility it is.
How does this site stack up against other task sites that the city has planned?
Well, it's quite a bit further out of town. It is different in the sense of having RVs and stuff. There's, you know, it's out on Portland Road North. It's not in the central city, so it's not anywhere near services. There's not really a bus line there. I heard on good authority that locals had asked about putting in a bus stop in that area so that people could get into town, get closer to services and stuff. That request to TriMet was denied. So it's just a little bit, it's a different whole scenario. I don't know. It might work well for some people and not for others.
Did you go out to the site itself?
I did. It's a bit marshy. It's a really interesting place. I mean, there's still a building out there that's rusted out. It looks like people have lived in there on and off for periods of time. It's kind of burned out, you know, moldy walls and stuff. I don't know if there's any real use for that industrial building, but yeah, there's some photos in this story this week in Street Roots too.
So over the two stories that we've talked about, what are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from these stories?
Well, staying with this one about the task site, you know, there is a process here. I think it's fair to say that the city and DEQ are working together on that process. Sometimes the city has ideas of things that don't always follow through on, and we're here to make sure that they do follow through on that so that this is safe for people. The story we don't want to tell is that the city is sending homeless Portlanders outside of the city onto a contaminated site, and we'd be really happy to report that they did everything they can do to keep people safe. On the sleeping ban, temporary injunction, you know, this is a process too. It's going to go through the courts, and this is significant relief for people who are really worried about how unreasonable it is to expect them to try to live life in a way that dodges, you know, enforcement and, you know, dodges just the way that they're trying to just kind of live. So that's a big win, and we will see where it goes from here.
Where can folks find your work for themselves?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy it from a vendor. They're usually in your neighborhood, and they accept cash, they accept tips, and Venmo. And you can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
No, thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about two of his articles in this week's paper. The first one, Circuit Court Judge Halts Enforcement of Portland's Sleeping Ordinance. The second one we talked about was called The City Has a Lot of Work to Do Before Its Next Task Site is Ready for People. More information on both of these stories is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
In September, the Police Accountability Commission, or PAC, presented a detailed 96-page package of proposed city code language in front of a largely skeptical city council. The PAC was made up of 20 volunteers from the Portland community who spent most of the last 2 years in an intense process of creating a new police oversight system for Portland in accordance with ballot measure 26-217, which was passed by 82% of Portland voters in 2020. The ballot measure enshrined a new vision for police accountability in the city's charter. It mandates that the new system be independent of the police and political interference, that its budget be pegged to 5% of the police bureau budget, and that it have the power to subpoena and discipline officers who are the subject of misconduct complaints. Aside from those non-negotiables, the PAC spent the last 2 years ironing out the details of the procedures and makeup of this new body.
Now it's up to the city to propose amendments and changes to the PAC's proposed code language, which will be further bargained between the city and the U.S. Department of Justice and the city's police union before being approved in their final form by the city council next year. Last week, the Oregonian obtained a copy of the city's counterproposal, which cuts nearly 70 pages from the PAC's version, and also significantly weakens several aspects of the system the PAC created after their lengthy and intensive process of research, outreach, and discussion over the past 2 years. On Sunday, we spoke with Dan Handelman, longtime member of Portland Cop Watch and a former member of the Police Accountability Commission, which disbanded at the conclusion of its work on August 31st.
The other day, I was at a meeting where somebody described the city council's, or the city attorney's proposal, really, as being based on the PAC's proposal, but that's like saying that those shards of pottery on the floor are based on a vase. I mean, you know, it's just like they basically took everything we did, threw it down on the floor, broke it, and then picked up little bits and pieces they liked, and then in order to try to glue it back together, they put in what they wanted, and it doesn't look anything like what was originally intended.
The overall oversight system created by the PAC has two main parts: an all-volunteer civilian board called the Community Board for Police Accountability, or CBPA, and a supporting city bureau called the Office of Community-Based Police Accountability, or OCPA, which answers to the civilian board. One of the fundamental pieces of the ballot measure and the language it enshrined in the city charter was a promise that no current or former law enforcement officers or their immediate families would be permitted on the new board. While the city's counterproposal keeps this prohibition in place, it does insert significant police involvement into the nominating process for board members. Here's former PAC member Dan Handelman again.
One of the criticisms we got back from several people in the city was, you going into too much detail. Okay, so we said, there'll be a nominating committee and we'll let them figure that out. And so instead, the city wrote in, this is what the nominating committee is going to look like, and they said one representative from the Portland Police Bureau and one representative from the Portland Police Association and one representative from the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association, which is outrageous, having three people with law enforcement picking members of a supposedly impartial, neutral review system. So, reading further into their document, it says that when they're picking who the director is going to be, those same people are going to be sitting on that.
The city also added another requirement for members of the citizen board, in addition to the prohibitions on cops and their immediate families. The city language requires that board members do not have a, quote, demonstrated bias for or against law enforcement, end quote. The city does not clarify what exactly the parameters of bias for or against police would be.
I think we've struggled at Portland Cop Watch. We've struggled with this term for years. Like, we're saying we want the police to be held accountable, and people interpret that as being anti-police. That's not an appropriate interpretation. But if whoever's in charge of making that decision gets to say, well, you're part of a group called Portland Cop Watch, and you said that officer who killed that person should be held accountable for it, if that's anti-police, then we're not going to have any kind of a reasonable membership on this board. I mean, they also downplayed the necessity of people on this board having to have lived experiences in neighborhoods that are over-policed, and they are making people go on a ride-along. If you've been exposed to police misconduct, you're not going to want to be in a police car with an officer for any period of time to, you know, in order to learn.
Again, that was Dan Handelman, former member of the Police Accountability Commission and an active member of Portland Cop Watch since the early 1990s. The city attorney and the PAC are far apart on the question of what cases the new oversight system will handle. In the PAC proposal, civilians would investigate nearly every category of alleged police misconduct. That approach is backed by the language of the ballot measure, which places no limits at all on the potential jurisdiction. But the city attorney has proposed a much more limited scope of work.
I really want to read you a part of the charter that this code is supposed to be based on. And I don't want to disparage the city attorney's office, but let me just say that it's pretty clear that they read something wrong. It says under Section 2-108, subsection C, the board may investigate other complaints or incidents of misconduct as they see fit or as mandated by city code. So in other words, they can investigate other complaints as they see fit, not that it has to be in city code, but the new code they propose says anything they add to that list has to be approved by city council. So that's in conflict with what the charter says.
Among the violations that the new oversight system would need to seek special counsel approval for are violations of the truthfulness directive. Untruthfulness is a fireable offense and would be handled by internal affairs instead of civilian investigators. Perhaps the biggest gap between what the PAC proposed and what the city attorney will present before council is in the area of transparency and community involvement. Transparency in the police accountability process has been a constant community demand and one that the police and the city have continued to push back against. Police review board meetings are closed to the public, the reports on their findings are heavily redacted, and aside from appeals that come before the Citizen Review Committee, the public has no access to deliberations on police discipline at all. The PAC proposal allowed for the possibility that meetings would be open to the public whenever possible, and the community would be allowed to contribute comments for their consideration. The city attorney, on the other hand, has removed the word transparency from the definition of accountability altogether and stipulated that all case discussions will be held in closed executive sessions. The final votes would be held in a public setting, but the substance of the allegations would not be stated.
They did take the word transparency out from the beginning of the document and then pulled out a lot of items that would have made this entire process more transparent. Some of them are major, such as removing the option, which is legal under state law, for the board to decide that a hearing is in the public interest and they want to hold it in, you know, in open session. But the officer gets to decide if they want to have an open session as well. But the language we put in about deciding if it's in the public interest is now gone. The word transparency actually does appear in their document at least once, because they're saying that the board members have to commit to upholding the city's core values of anti-racism, equity, transparency, communication, collaboration, and fiscal responsibility, which is very funny when you think about what the city has done to this plan. That they've gotten rid of the transparency, they've definitely ditched a lot of the anti-racism parts and equity parts that we built in.
Again, the changes will be presented by the city attorney at a public hearing November 15th at 2 p.m.
Certainly something they've said, that the people who voted for that in 2020 aren't the same people who are here now, and I don't think that's true. I mean, it's yes, the Black Lives Matter signs have gone away, and in fact, they took down the last murals of George Floyd from around the Pioneer Place Mall just this Friday, as a symbolic gesture, perhaps, as this is coming to a vote at City Council. But I think the people of Portland are still the same. And I think that even the people who have brought baseless allegations about what the PAC's intentions are said they believe in police accountability. I think most people in the city believe in police accountability. And I think that what the city has done is made it so that it's going to be very hard to hold police accountable.
That was Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and formerly of the Police Accountability Commission, who we spoke to on Sunday for this piece. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine.
Thank you. Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people